Welcome to the Pint and Click podcast. I'm Dave. I'm back with Tony and Kristen and Joel, and we're here to talk about things on Hoopla. Hoopla is a streaming service that the library has. If you are interested in digital media, there's movies, there's music, there's books, there's comic books. There's all sorts of things. Maybe there aren't books. There's audiobooks, right? And ebooks. That's right. Okay. So if you're interested in Hoopla, check it out. If you're not interested in Hoopla, or if you don't go to the Des Plaines Public Library, these are things that you should be able to find on your local library shelf as well. It's nothing particularly rare. First, we're going to talk about individual things that we each read or listened to or whatever, and then we're going to have a group discussion about Ghost in the Shell, the anime from 1995. But first up, we've got Joel. Joel, what are you going to talk about today?
I was going to talk about The Addiction. It's a film by Abel Ferrara, and it's actually an interesting story that the reason I want to talk about it with Hoopla is I saw a very, very long time ago, back in the 90s, when my days of going to Hollywood Video and walking out with a whole armload of videos on a VHS, and ever since DVDs came into play, it has not been anywhere available. When I found it on Hoopla, I was very excited to rewatch it and to kind of revisit myself back 20 years ago and see, like, does this stand up to the test of time? And it did, and it did not. Hmm. It is a film where it is an examination of evil versus redemption. Mm-hmm. It is not necessarily a horror film, but it wears the horror genre as a costume, essentially. It's filmed in black and white. It takes place in New York City, and it concerns a graduate student who is studying philosophy, and she is randomly bitten by a vampire. Although vampire is never mentioned in the film, it's pretty obvious is what it is. Mm-hmm. But it depicts the struggle of compulsion and determinism versus moral choice. It's also couched in a neo-noir light. It's a lot of light and dark, obviously. There's a lot of texture in the shots with the brick and the crisscross shadows. And it's more of an ideological transformation of her into the vampire versus a physical, what you normally see. Mm-hmm. And these are not cute vampires. These are ravaging, you know, better than, they believe themselves to be better than the humans. But there's also a meditation in the film of what humans do to each other. She is studying war crimes in her thesis mm-hmm. at the university. And by comparison, are vampires really that terrible? When you look at what humans are doing to each other as far as My Lai massacre or the Holocaust.
Sounds really interesting.
Some pretty deep issues going through it. It did hold up. It rewards the viewer with some panning shots. It jumps ahead in the plot, and then it kind of reveals what happens, you know, through a slow pan shot. And it's disturbing and visceral and philosophical, but at the same point, some people may think it's over the top, mm-hmm. Which is the case of Abel Ferrara's work in general. He's also the director of Bad Lieutenant and King of New York.
Oh, no kidding.
So it's just a bunch of different versions of New York. But and Christopher Walken and Lily Taylor are the stars in this movie. And this is probably my favorite depiction of Christopher Walken I've ever seen. Hmm. So that's, I think, one of the drawbacks was like, you know, is it really as great? And it was mm-hmm. his depiction. It's a little more over the top than I had experienced before, so mm-hmm. maybe it may not be for everybody, but it's well worth a watch if you have a philosophical bent to the story of good and evil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Bad Lieutenant. I like that one, but it was also really shocking. It's not a crowd pleaser. It's a
right.
It's a rough film to watch. So, you know, I'm wondering how the pacing goes for that for Addiction. Like you said, it jumps forward, and then you know, how does it use like tension to draw? I mean, you said it was disguised as a horror film.
Yes, so. You know what's going to happen, and there's a certain set of actions that happens through as each person's attacked. You know what's coming up, mm-hmm. but he takes his time setting up the situation and gives characterization to the person, so you feel like you're rooting for that person to get away, but then they don't.
Yeah.
So it's okay. It kind of reflects, you know, they're almost predetermined to be attacked in the film, mm-hmm. but you want them not to be.
Very cool.
Is it, I have to ask, I love Bad Lieutenant, is it, what do I want to say, as personally horrifying a story?
Or in is a it, sense,
or is it more
no.
these large themes that you're talking about?
No, it's a very personal story.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
All right. That sounds awesome. The Addiction is on Hoopla now if you're a Dutch Plains Library patron. We got to move on. Next up is Tony. Tony, what are you talking about?
All right. I'm talking about probably the polar opposite, a Disney movie soundtrack, which I know I grew up, you know, singing songs to Disney, and I lately haven't watched any of the animated features that, you know, Disney comes out with. But I saw Moana, and then on a couple people's recommendations, they said, oh, well, you know, the Moana soundtrack's on Hoopla. You should check it out. Or, the, you know, it's really good. The songs are really catchy, and they just stick in your head. And sure enough, like, it's a lot of fun to listen to. There's Lin-Manuel Miranda, the songwriter for Hamilton. And
which is kinda, also on Hoopla.
Which is also on Hoopla, good point. There's this really awesome combination of his kind of, like, pop and hip-hop inspired music that is kind of blended almost seamlessly with emphasis on like percussion and log drums and what you would find maybe typical or maybe with your maybe expectation of what like a Polynesian Hawaiian soundtrack might sound like. But yet it's a really cool soundtrack because it kind of keeps a light tone, but it deals with some really cool ideas of like maturity and exploration and coming into your own and kind of having to branch out for yourself into the world, you know, set sail, as it were, in this particular thing. So I would say the film and its animation and its color shines through in the music. And of course, Miranda's like awesome ability to like make light of kind of any kind of, even though the dialogue may not have been like something heavy or filled with facts or anything like that, I think it's like you could tell he's just having fun with the idea. And that maybe that's typical of like modern Disney movies or all the Disney, you know, musicals. And so some of the really neat highlights, I think, of the soundtrack were like Dwayne Johnson has a song. He's kind of like the other main character, Maui, who's like a demigod, and he sings a song about, you know, because it's classic Dwayne Johnson, The Rock. He's like overconfident, and I think in that regards, the song was written perfectly for him, and it's very, The song is called You're Welcome, like, because I'm a demigod, I made everything.
What can I say except you're welcome for the tides, the sun, the sky? Hey, it's okay, it's okay. I'm just an ordinary demi-guy.
And that's one of the ones
that... Expectation of gratitude, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, the expectation of gratitude. And that's one of the great ones that has, like, the rap sprinkled in and everything, and it moves the story forward, yet it's very much defining the character all in one time. So that's a lot of fun. And then there's a song sung by Jemaine Clement of Flight of the Conchords. And that's... Oh. Yeah, and that's, like, a song that kind of one of the trials for Maui to go through is he has to get his powers back, you know, going to a cave and facing a monster. And the monster is a shiny clam, or a shiny, oh gosh, lobster, sorry. And it's done in a very glam rock style, so it's all about him being shiny and, you know, showing off his style.
I'd rather be shiny like a treasure from a sunken pirate wreck. Scrub the deck and make it look shiny. I will sparkle like a wealthy woman's neck. Just a sec. You'll never be quite as shiny. You wish you were nice and shiny.
It's hard to say it's done in the style of David Bowie, but everything, when I was watching that, I was like, this sounds like Starman. It sounds like, you know, Changes or Life on Mars or something. But I looked it up, and actually, sure enough, like, yeah, that's where the inspiration for that song came, I guess. So it was a lot of fun, and another one of the, probably the most catchy song on the soundtrack there, so... Yeah, I don't know. It's a really cool thing you can find on Hoopla. And in addition to having the main soundtrack, there's actually like 50 tracks on this thing. So it's like 2 hours long.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. So it has like the pop style ones, not just the straight rip from the movie soundtrack.
Mm-hmm. Does it stand on its own then if you haven't seen the movie? Because I haven't seen the movie.
I would say you could probably, yeah, you could definitely. It stands on its own because really the main parts of the story kind of are inherent in the music. They're usually using music to move the plot forward anyway. So it's, you know, striking out and all that. So.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any songs that got stuck in your head?
Definitely. I mean,
Can you sing a little ditty for us?
Oh, gosh. I want to, but I'm afraid I would hurt the listeners' ears.
We'll leave that to The Rock.
Yeah, we'll leave that to The Rock.
Does he do well? I'm a wrestling fan, as podcast listeners know, but...
Yeah, I think he does all right. I mean, I think it's surprisingly good for The Rock, because I didn't know he was a singer, and... His voice is kind of strange. It's not what you would expect, you know?
He's many talented, multi-talented that guy.
He is.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the Moana soundtrack. That is also on Hoopla, but it If you, like I say, that should be available widely at almost any library if your library doesn't carry Hoopla. All right, I'm up next, and I'm going to talk about Green Lanterns Volume 1. This is what I'm most excited about Hoopla, is that they have graphic novels and comic books that are current, that are new. It used to be these streaming and download services used to have something that was, 10 years old, 20 years old. That was all well and good if you want to read the classics. But if you want to be current, if you want to be up to date with what's going on with Batman and Wonder Woman and all the DC comics, then Hoopla has you covered, because this is comics from last year and this year. Volume 2 just showed up on Hoopla. So I'm going to talk about Green Lanterns. That's plural, because we've got a couple of them now. Now, if you're not familiar with Green Lanterns, I feel I should explain. Green Lantern is a superhero that is chosen by an intergalactic police force, and they use their rings as a weapon of power, as a communication tool, as a Wikipedia that is always available. And recently, the rings kind of, they choose the Green Lantern person. They kind of fly through the galaxy. When a Green Lantern dies, the ring leaves the body and flies through the universe and finds someone who's suitable to wield it. And it is kind of interesting that two rings chose Earthlings, because we're talking about the whole universe and all the sectors, the thousands of sectors therein. Why would it choose two on Earth? Well, Hal Jordan, who's still around, thinks that it's because something bad is going to happen on Earth and we need more Green Lanterns in this sector. So anyway, our Green Lanterns on Earth are Jessica Cruz and Simon Baz, and they cannot be more different. Jessica Cruz is a young woman who struggled with anxiety for most of her life. She just recently developed agoraphobia. She couldn't leave her house, and she has been locked inside for 3 years, and she just recently started to come out and reacquaint herself with her family and her friends. Simon Baz is as overconfident as they come. He loves the ring that he's been given. He loves the power. He loves the strength that he can display. And he wastes no time in beating up bad guys and becoming a superhero of his own. He's a very proud person, proud of his family, proud of his heritage, proud of his religion. And they find themselves coming up against some Red Lanterns. Now, if the Green Lanterns are powered by will, the Red Lanterns are powered by rage. So they're your classic bad guy who's just mad at the galaxy, mad at everyone, and their rage fuels their rings, fuels their power. And Volume 1 is a story of Red Lanterns come to Earth. They've got a sinister plot involving infecting humans with the power of rage. So your average human becomes like this anger zombie who runs around and wants to attack anyone they come in contact with, and they spread the rage to other humans, and these two Green Lanterns have to stop it. I could go on and on about the various colors and the emotional spectrum of the DC universe, and I'm sure all those will come into play eventually, but if you're interested in Green Lanterns, and if you're interested in new DC, this is a great place to jump in, because these are characters that are interesting and accessible. To be honest, I tried to read Wonder Woman first, and I found it completely confusing. I did not know the story. I did not know the characters. It was a task to read. I had to reference Wikipedia. But Green Lanterns was a great jumping in point, because I'm a little behind on my DC. I'm a Marvel guy. I'm an Image guy. But my DC is lacking. So I read Volume 1, and that's what I'm recommending today. And I'm going to, first chance I get, read Volume 2 as well, because I'm excited to see where this story goes.
Nice. I don't know too much about Green Lantern. Have you read the older ones?
I have a little bit. Hal Jordan is probably the most famous name. Mm-hmm. And he was written by Jeff Johns, who is kind of the head honcho over at DC now. And those are great if you want to read those. It's a little confusing because he wrote a story called Rebirth. And that is separate from what DC is doing now, which is called Rebirth. It's comics. It's always confusing. I don't know what to tell you other than you're going to have to figure that out for yourself. But Jeff Johns' run on Green Lantern was great. This is a totally different writer, Sam Humphries, who has done some other things that I like.
I mean, Green Lantern seems to just be a name. Like, even if you're not a huge DC comic fan, there's people that just love Green Lantern. Do you have any idea why that is?
No, not at all. It's kind of a, I feel like he's the best of the B tier, You've got your Batman, you've got your Wonder Woman, sure. You got your Superman. They're the ones people know. You ask anyone on the street, they know those three names. Mm-hmm. But then you get down into the Green Lantern and the Flash and Aquaman, and they're like the second level down.
Yeah.
Why Green Lantern appeals, I don't really know. He's a little bit more relatable. He's all about overcoming fear, asserting your will, being confident in the face of uncertainty. And so those maybe resonate better than Superman, who can do all things at all times whenever he wants, and that's not really relatable. So maybe it's that. But to be honest, I'm kind of a newcomer to Green Lantern, so I don't really know a lot of the appeal.
Did you guys see the Green Lantern movie by chance?
I did. I kind of want to watch it again now that I've read the book. It's not so bad is my quick review.
I'm going to have to check it out.
I haven't seen it either.
It's Ryan Reynolds who played Deadpool.
Another B-list superhero.
So he kind of jumped sides. He did a DC movie, and now he's doing a Marvel movie in Deadpool. So a little bit of a fan controversy there, but it's no big deal. We'll let him. Yeah. You know, he did such a good job in Deadpool. I can't fault him for being in that movie. So that's Green Lanterns Volume 1 by Sam Humphries. You should check it out. If you're like, I've never read a comic, I want to read something new, something current, get up to date, it's great for that. All right. And next we have Kristen. Kristen, what are you talking about?
So I'm talking about Pan's Labyrinth, or El Laberinto del Fauno in Spanish. And I'm taking us back about 11 years to 2006, when Guillermo del Toro produced, edited, and directed Pan's Labyrinth. And the movie takes place in 1944 in Spain, 5 years after the Spanish Civil War. And essentially, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, the Francoists are in power and they're clashing with the Spanish Maquis or, in the movie, they're more known as the rebels. And the Francoists are really a fascist government. So the main character, Ophelia, she is a little girl, and she's played by Ivana Baccaro, and they go to live with her stepdad, Captain Vidal, who works for this fascist government. And her mother, Carmen, played by Ariadna Gil, is pregnant with El Capitan's baby. So essentially what happens is there's two parallel stories going on. There's Ophelia discovers this labyrinth, and after she goes in this labyrinth, she ends up meeting El Fauno, who essentially tells her that she is an immortal princess, and they were meant to meet. And so he gives her three different tasks that she has to complete. And then on the other side of this, there's these clashing between the fascist government and the rebels. The mom, you know, Ophelia does not want to be there. So this Pan's Labyrinth, and the labyrinth is kind of like this fantasy away from reality. Ophelia basically tells her mom, I want to leave. And the mom is essentially like, why did you marry this guy? And the mom says, you know, you'll understand when you get older. And basically, you get to see that the mom did this to essentially, I think, save them. And then I don't want to give too much away, but there's also some informants working for Capitan. So they're going to the rebels and essentially helping them with, give them medicine and to also bring them supplies. So what essentially happens is, I think there are some themes. One of them is what I'd call machismo. So there's a few moments where El Capitan tells the doctor, because the mom is sick. The mom is bedridden. The mom's in a wheelchair, per the instructions of Capitan. But, you know, you overhear Capitan telling the doctor, like, basically, if you have to decide between saving my wife and saving my son, save my son. And then while that's happening, Ophelia goes on her first task, which is essentially she has to go into this underworld. She has to get a golden key. And so I feel like, you know, like in most fables, even fairy tales that you read, the character has to go through this journey. And there are these moments of redemption. There are moments of mistake. And essentially at the end, right, you want to see some kind of triumph. I don't want to give too much away about the baby, but the mom does get sicker and sicker. And Ophelia, for one moment, I think this is kind of a climax in the movie, Ophelia makes a mistake. So the second task was she had to go get this knife. And the fawn tells her, whatever you do, there's going to be a feast. Whatever you do, do not eat this food. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the table, there's this, I don't even know if you want to call him a man, but he's basically all skin. He's really scary looking. He mm-hmm. doesn't have eyes. And then in front of him, there's a plate with two eyeballs. Mm-hmm. And he's just, you know, paused there. So as the viewer, you're like, okay, this is not good news.
No.
And then there's just this, you know, sparkling food and drink. And I didn't mention this earlier, but there's also some fairies. And so these fairies are like getting in her face, like, stop, Ophelia, don't. And of course, she eats a few grapes. The character who is at the end of the table takes the eyeballs and puts it in his hands and then lifts them up in front of his face and essentially runs after Ophelia. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, she was given some magic chalk, so she was able to create a little doorway out. But from there, you know, the fawn tells her, like, we're done. So you really need to watch the rest of the movie to see if the story really is done or if Ophelia actually makes it to the last task.
I love Pan's Labyrinth. I watched mm-hmm. it just a couple months ago by circumstance. And if you love Guillermo del Toro, this is one of his best in terms of storytelling and horrific special effects. Mm-hmm. Did you watch it? Is it dubbed in English? I watched it in Spanish with English subtitles. Does anyone know if there's an English version?
I don't, but I actually should have mentioned that earlier. It is, as Dave said, it's subtitled mm-hmm. in English, so you will have to have the energy to want to read subtitles when you mm-hmm. watch it. But if there's a dubbed version, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. We should have researched that before the podcast.
But in Hoopla, you'll be reading subtitles.
Yeah. Which is, I think, the way to do it. Mm-hmm. The performances are great, even though I know very little Spanish. The performances, the emotion on these characters are great, and I would prefer to keep that intact.
Mm-hmm. The immersion into another language to maintain the culture.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And then with, you know, dubbing can always be off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't quite match with the movement of their mouth. So yeah. At least with them speaking Spanish, everything is seamless.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Kristen. That's Pan's Labyrinth, once again on Hoopla, but almost certainly available on DVD here at Des Plaines. And finally, we're going to talk about Ghost in the Shell, and we're talking about the original 1995 anime that is available on Hoopla. It's also available here at the library on DVD. I know because I just returned it, so hopefully it's if you're interested in watching it, it'll still be on the shelf if you come by. So Ghost in the Shell is the story of Major Motoko Kusanagi, and she is a young woman who is also a cyborg, and she works for Section 9, which is a, I don't know how to describe it exactly, paramilitary, loosely government-affiliated security force that is charged with tracking down the Puppet Master, who is a most wanted hacker, and they don't know much about. And so the movie itself is kind of this detective story where they're trying to follow leads to the Puppet Master. They don't really know. They don't know anything if it's a he or she. They assume it's American, but they don't really know because it's a hacker who has been operating behind the scenes. But the story itself is very much about identity and consciousness in a new technological age. People have either they're cyborgs with computer programmed brains, or they're humans with technologically advanced minds with actual, like, you know, microchips inserted into their brain. Something like a coating or a shell placed around the brains, I think, is depicted in the movies. And so it's very much about the identity of this young woman and the identities of computer programs and in an age of information and technology. So what do we think of Ghost in the Shell?
I mean, my initial reaction was just that there's a lot of information crammed into the dialogue that, and I watched it in English, so, but I also had to have the subtitles on, and just, it was a very fast-paced thing. It was crammed together very neatly, like a short story is, you know.
And it is a little over an hour, just to put that out there.
Yeah, exactly. So, it's not very long, and it's, but it does get right, it opens with some really cool, you know, action, but I think very quickly you see the really great character portraits of the major, and her team working around her. And I think that's really cool. I think that kind of defines the story a bit for me. When you see it from their perspective and you see the world around them. But it was really kind of difficult to grasp. I think it's a tough movie to like wrap your head around if it's your first time seeing it. Like I've tried watching it before and it's a little slow to start. Mm-hmm. And then it goes really, you know, it kind of goes fast at different times.
I agree. I had a hard time following along.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely think that I'd recommend watching it more than once if you haven't read the mangas. Like,
mm-hmm.
I would potentially need to see it a second time. And I even had to, like, I watched it and I went back and I was like, let me go look on Wikipedia and see, like,
exactly that.
What I missed. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't connect all the, you know, like you said, it's fast paced. There's a lot of information and there's a lot of, it's also a very deep story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I feel like there's a lot of layers to it. So it's something you almost have to just really contemplate after.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting that like, to me, it's like, if I didn't hear about this movie so many times and mm-hmm. try watching it maybe once or twice, I wouldn't know that it was such a rich movie, you know, it's mm-hmm. that type of thing where the animation is really impressive and the idea of the world building is really, really, when you think about, you know, trying to portray like this synthesis of technology, cybernetics and computers into everyday society, they were imagining the picture of this, like the actual look of it in animated form in 1995 is really impressive.
Yeah.
Because just the techniques they use are really cool. And the colors and the displays. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I don't know if Dave mentioned this. The movie came out in 1995, and this world that the major's in is taking place in 2029.
Mm-hmm.
So,
so we're only 12 years out.
Yeah.
But I think it's just that impressive from that perspective that we're watching this film in 1995, and it's these are still, you know, applicable, if not more so now than it was 22 years ago.
Yeah.
So that was just fascinating to
right.
me. It was almost like watching a time capsule in reverse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it dealt with identity and cloning and not cloning, so to speak, but the hybrid technology mm-hmm. that, you know, and now we're encountering today with 3D printing.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. it was just incredible.
Yeah. It's very prophetic at its time and now almost like commonplace ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yes, we've, I mean, we haven't implanted microchips into our brain just yet, but, you know, the idea that our sense of identity now in the social age is much different than it was in the mid-90s, and they kind of saw that coming.
I would say, though, the one different thing is that with Major, you know, she's a robot in a way, part robot, part human or whatever. Mm. And the thing is, what I think is different is that, you know, here's an example of someone who is part, you know, computer and is having an identity crisis.
Sure.
Right? So it's just like, whoa, mind blowing.
Yeah. And then there's the
computer's having identity crises. Mm-hmm. Like, whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was getting the chills too at the idea of, well, number one, to respond to that, there's the person who thought he had a daughter, but really he was hacked into, you know, he was mm-hmm. Ghost hacked. Mm-hmm. So his whole personality, his memories were reprogrammed. And to me, I think the most evocative thought of that is that we spend so much of our lives and we have a lot of our history, you know, in a computer now. Like, so, you know, it's like turning on Facebook and seeing like different memories than you remember, you know, mm-hmm. if that were to happen or if your life was hacked, you know,
mm-hmm.
And your Facebook was rewritten, you know.
How much would you retain within yourself versus being stored in that? Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. So there's some really awesome like philosophy in that particular thing. And just as an aside, I was curious about, there was a 60 minute thing on like brain hacking that was like an ex-Googler talking about how like these systems are designed to keep you in them, you know, and there's no second thought necessarily given in these giant tech companies about whether that's right or wrong, you know,
mm-hmm. so, lack of ethics.
Just, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Ethics. Or,
the lack of ethics and the drive for like complete immersion because the system is what's important, you know, mm-hmm. and that's not really questioned
mm-hmm.
as a good thing or a bad thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, this movie was made in response to, well, computers are here and they're mm-hmm. becoming, they're changing culture in Japan, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And another thing in the movie that I reacted to, there were definitely, there's violence,
mm-hmm.
FYI, everyone out there. And there are some moments where I'm like, oh, this is the end of the movie. Like, the major's done for. And then, you know, her partner comes and is just like, I'm getting you out of here. You know, you look kind of beat up. And she speaks and you're like, whoa. Like, how are you still alive?
Yeah, for all the philosophical talk and the grand ideas that we're talking about, it, at its core, it's an action movie. Mm-hmm.
It's a buddy cop movie, too.
Yeah. There's gunfights and martial arts and
car chases.
Car chases, yeah, exactly right. Mm-hmm. And explosions here and there.
And suspense, yeah, the thermo op. Yeah. Hiding.
Blood.
So, yeah.
Blood and wires and guts.
So I do agree that it's a little slow in the beginning, but then it starts to pick up. And when it picks up, it is an action movie with these kind of horrific existential moments sprinkled throughout. And I think it's really effective at what it does. So like if it were just like an hour and a half essay about the details of a robot experiencing an identity crisis, you'd get bored or it wouldn't be exciting, it wouldn't be engaging, but this young woman with her life on the line engages you. And so you worry about her, you're concerned about her, and that makes her identity crisis all the more interesting and compelling.
And even though like the puppet master's a bad guy, I mean, he actually does kind of play a catalyst for this identity crisis. So,
yeah, he's kind of one of those, is he really a bad guy at the end of the movie? You're not really sure. Like, from his point of view, like, he makes a good argument.
Mm-hmm.
The animation holds up. The animation is still, there's both ink and paper animation combined with CGI. The CGI is a little dated, but it fits. In context, I think it still fits.
What's CGI?
Computer-generated graphics. There's, you know, with the scans, there's scans of the brain or scans of the body, and that was CGI. Most of the movie was animated. So it kind of looks a little bit like Lawnmower Man, where the CGI is dated, but it doesn't jar you the way Lawnmower Man does. It still fits in very well. I think because they didn't try for too much. They didn't try to make it realistic, and then it would fall in the uncanny valley. So it holds up. If you're not into anime, this is the one to watch as a litmus test to see if maybe you do. This and Akira, I guess, are the two pillars of the anime gateway, so to speak, into this entire world of art, of animation, of ideas, of a different way of storytelling from what I'm used to, which I famously don't like. I don't know about you, but I tell everyone I know I don't like anime. But I do like this, so if you haven't tried anime or if you tried it and you don't like it, give Ghost in the Shell a try. It's streaming on Hoopla, so why not? Just give it a watch. And it's not that long.
It's like an hour and 10 minutes.
An hour and 20 minutes.
It didn't even feel that long. My wife watched it with me, and she was surprised when it was over.
I agree. Yeah.
Any final thoughts? Do we all recommend Ghost in the Shell? Did anyone not like it? Or
I thought it was pretty solid.
Yeah.
I liked it.
It's not my favorite anime, but I feel like it's one of those animes that you hear a lot about.
Mm-hmm.
And as a lot of people probably know, the actual movie's out now. So I definitely feel like if you want to see the movie that's in theaters or you read the manga, like definitely at least watch it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, give it a shot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'd recommend it.
Yeah, I recommend it. I think it's definitely it's worth the time. It's worth the investment, which is very small. You know, it's an action movie. It's an action cartoon, I should say, that I find compelling. And the deeper aspects of it, you can take or you can leave. If you really want to, you can sit around all day thinking about the complexities of it, or you can just enjoy an action ride and say, that was pretty good. So that's Ghost in the Shell from 1995. My goodness, it's been 20 years since I watched that movie the first time. I hate to admit. I guess 20 years is a good enough turnaround for the live action movie. Unfortunately, we haven't seen. I hear it's not that good. I'm sorry to say. I wish it were. I like Scarlett Johansson, though there's some controversy about her casting. She is one of the. I read she is connected to the highest grossing movies of 2016. Mm-hmm. Of all the actors and actresses that appeared in movies in 2016, her movies made the most money. So good for her. I think Samuel Jackson holds that distinction most years, but this time he didn't do it.
Mm-hmm. So. And she was also in Lucy, which is a really good movie about kind of an intelligence, I think.
Yeah.
You know, that's a very original one by the guy who did Fifth Element. So
yeah,
check out Lucy.
Action scenes in Lucy are amazing. So we can't recommend that because we haven't seen it, but you know, if it has any of the depth of the original, I think it might be a good watch as well.
And one other thought about Ghost in the Shell is that it's contributed as a pillar to the anime community, but it was also an inspiration for the Wachowski siblings with The Matrix.
Oh, absolutely.
So yeah, it really kind of helped snowball that effect.
Yes, cyberpunk seems to be coming back, and I am excited by that notion. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a new Blade Runner coming out this year. The sequel to Blade Runner is in November, I believe. There's a big video game coming from CD Projekt Red called Cyberpunk 2049, so I am excited to kind of reacquaint myself with that genre again. Yeah. I should read Neuromancer one more time.
Right.
Yeah, I was gonna say, Netrunner.
When I read Neuromancer, I had a very similar feeling. Like, this book is way smarter than I am, and I'm okay with that. I'll try to catch as much as I can, you know, similar to the Ghost in the Shell. It's like, this movie is very smart and very fast.
Mm-hmm. So that's Ghost in the Shell. You can check it out on DVD, or you can see it on HooplaDigital.com. If you're a Desplaines patron, you can definitely check it out. HooplaDigital.com allows you 10 checkouts per month. So you can go on, you can check out all 5 of the things that we talked about today, and then a couple more before May comes around. I definitely recommend it. If you're not a Desplaines patron, see if your local library has HooplaDigital.com. A lot of them do. If not, you know, go check out the DVD. Go check out the graphic novel or the movie or the soundtrack or the Blu-ray of all the things that we talked about today. Thanks, and that is the Pint and Click podcast. We'll see you next time.
See you later.